Which one is that, Brad?
218.
What to do?
Yeah.
I got a letter.
Well, that's the one where.
Clerk will note those members present. Representative Martin is excused. Representative Lindquist and Otto will be slightly delayed, as will Representative Blumenauer and Burrows. Hope that we'll have a full complement pretty soon. First, I want to bring it to the attention of the committee. House Bill 3077, which the bill would pass out on election procedure. If there's no objection, I would like to have us return the bill before us. We didn't have a chance, Secretary of State's office did not have a chance to comment on the provisions of the bill, and I think that they have some valid points to raise that we might as well take care of it before it gets to the floor and it gets to be a major problem. Is there any objection? If not, so ordered, and we'll bring it back before us. Representative Sam Johnson, I think, has a quick bill, I think.
2460, Mr. Chairman.
A quick report on that.
I have Jane Earhart with me here. Do you mind if she
no.
sits with me? Mr. Chairman, you and members of the committee, you'll recall that I was asked to speak about this last week or a couple days ago or whenever it was. And I wasn't familiar with it at all, but I have become more familiar, and Jane has written it, and so she's very familiar with it. Basically speaking, it is this, that the irrigation and drainage district got permission, I don't know from whom, but just arranged between themselves, I would imagine, that they did not revise their laws with the law revision, when the law revision work was done on uniform boundaries. The irrigation districts and drainage districts are land-based as opposed to people-based in the uniform boundaries. So they were left out of the law revision work, and they promised to get this in this year. And everyone, I know of no outstanding ones, but there may be some. Most of the drainage and irrigation district managers and directors, I think they call themselves, have worked on this bill. The reason my name is on it is because one of the leading lights in Oregon, and has been for a number of years, is LaSalle Cole. And he lives in Prineville, and he's the manager of the Ochoco Irrigation District. He and I have talked about this for a long time, and he asked me to put these three bills in. 2460, 61, and 62, and I did, and that's how I happen to become involved in them. Now, I would like to have Jane, if she doesn't mind, and if you permit it, to go through this, indicate to you the scope of this bill. I'd be glad to carry it so that your members don't have to worry about that aspect, and
Intruder's passage.
Yeah, you're reading my mind. So, Jane, if you would tell them about the scope of it and what it amounts to, we'd be very appreciative.
Mr. Chairman, the bill takes, first, it takes all the present statutes in the irrigation and drainage district law out. It repeals those few provisions they have. And this is enacted in. To take over the procedure for dissolution or reorganization in the case of these two districts. it could only be, you will see in section two, it can only be initiated, a dissolution or reorganization, by electors who are landowners in the district and own, represent half the acreage in the district. This is somewhat different from the standard procedure of other districts, and that's why I'm pointing out some of these provisions to you.
Can we ask questions as she goes, or should we wait till you're through? Is this a change from present procedure?
Now, there I
that, or I mean, the one half.
The whole bill is new. Everything in it is new. A new language. And about the one half, what Jane said was that most times the resident votes by head count. And in this type of drainage and irrigation, it's by acres. And I would offhand say no, but it's a good point to note, and I'll find out.
Jane, is it my understanding there is no procedure then for these districts to dissolve at this time?
Yes, there is some procedure, yes.
There is some procedure?
Those sections noted in the title that are repealed by the bill.
That are repealed?
Yes.
Okay, does this conflict with any other bills moving then?
I don't know about that, Jane.
Does not?
Go ahead.
Okay.
The section two sets out the matters that have to be in the petition, and you'll notice that that includes a statement about the debt from the assets of the district. So, and the subsection three is very important, especially the irrigation district, but it's important in all these procedures that no dissolution or reorganization can take place, can impair the rights of creditors. And he continues to have his rights. The obligation, he can enforce it. Then section three puts out the particulars of what happens to a petition when it's filed, and section four. I'll call to your attention, it contains some of the provisions that were enacted in the uniform procedure that applies to other special districts, such as the signatures have to be put on the petition within the last 6 months, and there, although the petitions are filed with the secretary, then the secretary takes them and checks with the county clerk's office to certify registered voters in April. These things are all put together. Then, section five, when the petition is found to be valid in enough signatures, then they hold a hearing on it on notice. And subsection 2 on page 4 describes what's in the notice. And the notice states that if more than 10% of the qualified electors and voters in the district request an election, then the matter goes to an election. And this is a manner of providing for elections that's used in the other special district procedure, too. Then, section 6 and 7, what happens if there is an election or if there isn't an election. Then, in section 8, if, when this is all decided, with or without an election, if the proposition of dissolution or reorganization is approved, the matter then goes to the circuit court. And this is unique and not like the other district procedures. And the petition to the court requested to examine the regular, you can see on page 5, I'm reading from about in the middle of page, line 13-14. The petition requests the court to examine and determine the regularity and legality and correctness of the proceedings and determine and adjudicate the rights and liabilities, etc. So that before this district, these kinds of districts are dissolved, we have a court proceeding adjudicating the rights of all parties.
May I ask Jane a question, Mr. Chairman? Is in section 7, where they outline what is going to happen, and they ask for the vote, then the court, in effect, confirms it, rather, or finds fault with it, rather than creates it or initiates
right.
it. Is that right?
Right.
So the people know what they're voting on before the court sees it. Then they vote for dissolution or not.
Yes.
And then the court reaffirms it or reviews it.
And in a way, supervises.
Yes.
Winding up proceedings.
But does not initiate any of the terms of the dissolution.
Yes, it doesn't.
Thank you.
What is the difference, or why the difference in the circuit court and the other dissolution procedures? Why is it different?
Well,
so?
I can't explain that like the irrigation district lawyers could tell you, but they're very concerned about the rights of the creditors in these cases. A lot of the money comes from the federal government, and they're long-term loans, and I'm just guessing, but I think it's because There is a procedure in the irrigation district law where these, or that applies to irrigation districts, where once they're even formed, they are required to take the matter into court and get a declaration. Well, the court reviews their formation proceedings to see that everything is all right. And it's sort of stamped by the court to be okay before they go ahead and issue bonds and make bonds or put a lot of money in. So it's not out of keeping with their usual practice.
You mentioned to me, Jane, about the money coming on. Oh, it's in the next page. Yes, yeah, sorry.
I think 9 just elaborates on this court proceeding and how it is handled and all the details of this winding up procedure.
In talking to these irrigation attorneys and so forth, when we're talking about dissolution, we're not talking about discontinuing the irrigation system, are we? We're more talking about changing the ownership or the policy, the direction of policy. Mm-hmm. Did you get that impression?
I think we could just quickly,
I'll check that out.
If we just quickly summarize the bill, the differences in this procedure as opposed to the one they're following now, what would they be?
Now, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I was expecting Mr. Bryant to be here when I discussed this with Mr.
I expected him to be here, too. He came down, Mr. Chairman, with some attorneys. And unfortunately, there was a postponement of the committee hearing or whatnot, and he couldn't. I asked him to come. He offered to come. He had to get a 2 o'clock plane for South Dakota or someplace on a case. He offered to come down. I told him I didn't think we'd be ready for him at 1 o'clock, and so he isn't here. But I'll make sure we get that information, the difference between the two.
Okay.
This and the old ones.
The difference between this and the other kind of special district is that this winding up procedure is just done by the board of the district. They gather the assets together and pay the debts and turn the rest over to wherever it's supposed to go, when that's always spelled out in the statute. And if somebody doesn't like, that's why they could take it to court afterwards. But this requires it to go to court. I think those are the main points of it, Mr. Chairman.
Well, that's fine. Thank you, Jane. But I'll make sure I get that point, and there's 2 or 3 other points here. And as I say, we'll have a little time before.
Okay. Representative Ragsdale.
I'd like to preface my questions by saying I certainly am glad that you volunteered to carry this bill.
Well, I thought I could slip through without even finding out what it was about. But I see I've been caught. So I'll know it by the time it gets to the floor.
Jane. Section 8, page 5, section 8. Let's see if I understand this right. Here's it in there that the majority of the qualified electors and landowners representing at least 1/2 of the acres are necessary to vote against dissolution or reorganization. Further down, it is found and declared that a majority voted for dissolution. And it doesn't. Majority there, just apparently meaning majority of those voting, doesn't speak anything representing 1/2 of the acres, or doesn't speak to anything about being landowners.
Good point.
And I'm not quite sure that, to be very candid with you, I'm not quite sure that I understand how you pass dissolution when in one case you're talking about majority, and in another case you're talking about majority of voters and landowners representing at least 1/2 of the acres of the land. That would require, I would think, a turnout of 50% of the landowners.
Well, let's see. Read the whole sentence. It says, upon the canvas of the votes, it is found and declared to the district board that a majority of the qualified electors and landowners of the district representing at least 1/2 of the acres and so on voted against the disillusionment,
right.
The petition for disillusionment or reorganization shall be denied,
right.
And no further action should be taken thereon. However, if it is found that the majority voted for the dissolution and so on, the district shall, within 60 days. I don't see the...
Okay, my question, the second sentence says that a majority must vote for dissolution.
Yes.
Right. First sentence says that more than a majority must vote against dissolution. You follow me? The second sentence says a majority must vote to pass it.
Mm-hmm.
Inference is that if the majority doesn't vote, it fails. But the first sentence requires more than a majority not voting. It requires to be half the landowners, representing half the landowners, and there's a conflict there.
Would the words "the majority" refer to the majority you described above?
I think that's what was intended, that in line 10, that word "the majority" refers back to the kind of a majority described in line 5 and 6 and 7.
Well, all right, that isn't clear at all to me.
But it is the same kinds of voters.
Okay.
Do you think representing more than 50%?
It would, you know, however, if a majority of the qualified electors and landowners representing at least one half of the acres land assessed by the district voted at 4.
That's very confusing.
Should that majority of majority as it's meant in this bill be in the definitions in section 1? It's not the usual meaning of majority.
And is that practical? I'm just trying to think of a case. Is it possible for an irrigation district to have one half of the land owned by one owner,
mm-hmm.
and 30 other owners owning, 51% owned by one owner?
It's always been our trouble with land versus people, and that's why the irrigation districts, as I indicated, wanted to have the land speak rather than the people speak.
Well, here you're allowing both to speak, in possibly a confusing manner. You have to have a majority of the voters. Right, which might be 98% of the voters might not own 50% of land, and one voter owning 51% of land in the district could stop dissolution.
Jane, you're looking for the statutes?
If there isn't any objection, can we take this up at a later time?
Subpoena Ron Bryant.
All right. I didn't think
out.
There'd be any problems. And I'll become more familiar with it. We'll do it once more.
Okay.
Appreciate your patience.
If they're going back to look for questions, could I ask Jane a quick one? Is there any chance that a dissolution of a landowner district, Jane, would take place where there wasn't any board in them? Remember in the last session, we worked on dissolution in places where it had been sort of defunct and they didn't have a board, they hadn't had regular elections. Is there a chance of that in a
Of course, there's always a chance. I don't remember hearing about irrigation speaking defunct like.
In landowner districts, it wouldn't be possible, really, would it?
I think it's
Mr. Chairman, if Representative Johnson,
I think we would likely get a candidate for return.
Yeah.
I think what would be the best way is perhaps we could get a brief summary of the differences for this procedure over the present one, and that would just a brief memo on that would be very helpful to the committee. And then if we could resolve Representative Ragsdale's questions on that particular section and the voting process, I think we'd be able to be a little closer.
Now that I've found it, may I say one thing? An elector and an owner of land are defined in the first section of the chapter, and that's not a registered voter elector, it's a landowner. And he has to have so much land in order to vote in the district.
Well, we'll bring it back
okay.
to you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so much for your courtesy.
Thank you. Hospital 3077. Call on George Bell and Jack Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jack Thompson representing the Secretary of State's office, and I would ask that Mr. Bell lead off this general discussion with a statement.
Chairman, members of the committee, the Secretary of State's office wants to thank you for this opportunity to speak to House Bill 3077. As you know, Mr. Myers is not only out of Oregon, but out of the country and has been for a week. So I am here attempting to say some of the things I think he would want to say and would say himself if he were here. But I'm going to say in addition to that some things that I'm sure he would not say. He's a more prudent person than I am. In candor, I must say that we were somewhat startled to learn that this bill turned up on your committee agenda last Saturday morning. Our office had no prior knowledge that committee action was planned in this area of the election laws, though we have made every effort to work closely with your committee and provide whatever assistance we can. Beyond that, we were concerned to read in the newspaper that Oregon's pre-election reporting law is a joke, and that the entire chapter on campaign practices is, quote, ambiguous, conflicting, and has too many loopholes, end quote. That made a very interesting headline. But I ask you to compare the validity of those statements, which resulted in that headline, with the statements of the chief of the U.S. General Accounting Office, Gary Greenhall, who said in March of this year that, quote, Oregon has one of the best, if not the best, election administration setups in the country. That statement came out of a massive study conducted by the U.S. General Accounting Office of some difficulties in federal elections last year. Many states, including California, Michigan, and Ohio, were cited as needing extensive revisions or improvements in their election laws and administration. No recommendations of any kind were made for Oregon. Indeed, Oregon's laws and administration were suggested by the report as a model for other states to use in making improvements. And that story elicited a more pleasing and far more accurate headline than the one that came out of some testimony this committee heard last Saturday morning. Now, we're not here today to tell you that Oregon's election laws are perfect, but we are here to say that the Secretary of State's office has been doing its level best to correct whatever deficiencies there may be in those laws. For example, perhaps the most substantive amendment made to House Bill 3077 last Saturday morning has to do with an estimate, which may not be exceeded by more than 15%, of how much money a candidate intends to spend in the last 10 days before an election. We have argued for at least the last two legislative sessions that such an estimate requirement is vital, and we are pleased that your witness last Saturday now joined the Secretary of State's office in supporting our proposal. We got such a requirement through the House in the 1971 session, but it was deleted at the 11th hour in the Senate Elections Committee. We have argued publicly for it many times in the past 2 years, and we are working once more for its adoption. You will find that estimate provision contained in Senate Bill 571, which was introduced in this session at the request of the Secretary of State and the Oregon AFL-CIO. One final comment, Mr. Chairman. By long-established Oregon law and by tradition, the Secretary of State is Oregon's chief elections officer. And if there is any credibility in the U.S. General Accounting Office with its national perspective, we haven't been doing all that bad a job. It is gratifying, however, to find that some other offices in state government have taken a sudden and unusual interest in election laws. I say gratifying because we can use all the help we can get in improving these laws. And secondly, because such an interest in an area of law outside of their normal duties and functions indicates that those offices are in such immaculate operating order with respect to their own assigned duties and responsibilities that they are now free to dabble in other sections of the statutes. I'm sure such information makes all of us feel happy and more secure. My colleague, Mr. Thompson, now will go through House Bill 3077 and suggest some amendments by the Secretary of State's office.
Mr. Chairman, your clerk has delivered to you two documents. One is a proposed amendment to House Bill 3077, dated May 11, and a afterthought, a supplemental proposed amendment to the same bill carrying the same date. I must admit that the amendments, in some part at least, are more of a question and are asked to restore or to delete certain language and are not truly amendments. I've had a very short time to review the proposed amendments to House Bill 3077 that was presented to you last Saturday, but a quick calculation reveals that some 98% of the 40 pages of amendments contained herein have no substance whatsoever. What they do is remove the penalty clause from each and every section, as was recommended by the Legislative Council and by the chief drafter of Senate Bill 40, which is now the new criminal code, and were put into the law at the request of those individuals to conform with the criminal code. Now, we're going to take them all out and establish a penalty section. We have no quarrel with that, but that accounts for about 50% of the 40 pages before you, merely taking a penalty out of a section and putting it in a penalty section. And the other 50%, and it's interesting to me, in that I work with these laws as much as anyone, I think, that one of the claims set forth for the rewrite, and we find that the remaining 49% of the 99% of the changes in here are merely a rewrite. That, in my way of looking at it, and lay people must deal with this law, is more confusing than the existing law. The idea, I suppose, is to strip it down in length to reduce some redundancies that do occur in the present laws. For instance, an entire section dealing with definitions of offenses and enforcements have been taken out completely. Well, the committee, the interim committee that designed this law, did this deliberately. They divided the law into two separate and distinct sections. One was C&E reporting, and the other was general offenses. So by repeating the definition sections, and there's some slight differences in them, they thought they would make the law clear. Evidently, the sponsor of these amendments does not think so. There are only two substantive changes that I can find in these 40 pages as opposed to the present law. Now, if you want to dabble around with changing sentence structure from political committee or candidate to candidate or political committee, that's totally a legislative decision. It's okay if you just want to rewrite it. Chapter of the statutes, or that's okay. But we have had a very traumatic experience with this new law during 1972. There's no doubt about it. Candidates, political committees, administrators have all had to learn new ground rules and new laws. Now suddenly we're faced with having to do it all again. The question is raised, why hasn't the Secretary of State offered more changes in the election laws? Well, we feel that there's been enough changes in the election laws for a while anyhow, massive changes. There must be time for people to let the dust settle, to become accustomed to what these laws do and how they operate upon the individual political committee in Canada. Here in House Bill 3077, we're just changing it all around again. And as I understand the testimony, this massive amount of complaints that came out of the trying to enforce Chapter 260 was, I submit, part of the change in the law. We're going to experience the same thing should these proposed amendments be adopted. Okay, so much for that. Let's get down to some of the nitty-gritty things that we take some exception to. First of all, referring to the two-page document proposed amendments, we're suggesting in the repealing section the deletion of 260.502. Now, this has a very interesting history. The present law and the proposed amendments say that on the face of certain types of campaign literature, the name and the residence address of the sponsor shall appear. Now, that doesn't sound too startling if you're running for city councilman or even maybe for the House of Representatives. But what if you are a statewide office? Would your treasurer or you yourself want to have this tons of literature being delivered to your house? It does away with the possibility of establishing a temporary office or using a post office box as permitted in 260.520. We think that this has done a great service to the candidates and political parties of the state in the past. And here in the amendments, they say, no, you can't do that. You can't use the post office box. You can't use the storefront, even though you go through a filing of a document that clearly identifies it at all. We think that that should be deleted and that the existing statute 260.502 be allowed to remain in the statute.
Jack?
Yes, sir.
At this, I'm trying to reconstruct some of the things that come before me on this particular section before. And as I recall, most of the criticism of this section is the fact that, particularly on publications, or you can't find out who it is, really.
That's untrue. We have investigation after investigation report from the Attorney General's office on anonymous publication where they've had difficulty in finding. So, to avoid the difficulty in finding, in the proposed amendments, it says you don't have to do it, don't have to identify certain types of literature. Well, that's an easy and invasive way of getting around the problem. If you have a problem, let's face the problem and solve it. Now, in most of the cases that we sent to the, our complaints that we sent to the Attorney General's office, they were able to identify. There's only two out of about 30 anonymous publications complaints sent to the Attorney General's office where they could not truly find the person who distributed the material. In the other 28 cases, they found them. Now, all right, if that's a big issue, it's a big issue. You know, I can only let that be as it is.
Representative Wright.
Jack, as I remember these amendments to 3077, I don't think it does away with address. There's another section in these amendments that speaks to defining address differently than this does.
No, sir, I can't find it.
Because I remember when we had them presented to us that there was discussion about supposedly a problem with people, the post office box, and it said if there's a section in here that I'm trying to locate that speaks to
that. That prohibits the use of post office boxes.
And defines the use of residence.
As residence address. There is a prohibition against using post office boxes.
So your point then that you're making to us now is that the use of a post office box is appropriate.
Yes, if certain filings are made. All right, now on page 4 of the proposed amendments, and I'm sorry we have no line references here, on page 4, sub D, which is new language, is in direct conflict with House Bill 2180, which has been acted upon by this committee. Here we're trying to define major county, and I have no quarrel with the provisions of House Bill 2180 or the provisions submitted in the proposed amendments, but they should be uniform. You know, there's some sanctity in uniformity. On page 4, we're only saying one of these definitions should prevail. Also on page 4, they flirt with the idea of what an in-kind contribution is. Now, I would submit to you that the Secretary of State has proposed in Senate Bill 541 a more detailed and workable definition of an in-kind contribution than the fuzzy language we find in the proposed amendment.
I'm sorry, I don't find it on page 4. Am I looking on the wrong page?
Well, probably are.
Where do you find the definition of some kind of contribution?
Page 4, including the summary, is counting it as page 1. No, not counting it as page one.
The numbering system went a little awry, too.
I got page four, and I have city clerk at the top, county clerk, D.
Yep, right, that's the D he's talking about.
The D is the one on the principal county.
Okay, then I say major, defines major, person defines...
Oh, let's get over here in contribution.
Where, next page?
Well... It's in the definition.
Okay, bottom page five, is that where it is? No contribution shall receive, expense or made, no?
No, it's in the definition section under contribution. And I'm sorry, I have a typo error, too.
Well, you're talking about the in-kind contribution.
Yes.
Do you find where it is in the statute?
No, I thought we were looking for D.
In-kind contribution is not mentioned in the statutes, and that's what we're trying to get at in Senate Bill 541.
Yeah, and I understood what you said. What you said was you're not happy with the definition of in-kind.
That's correct.
I don't find it in here.
Well, I'll find it for you.
I don't think there was anything...
There's no such statement as in-kind contribution in this bill.
Doug, are you talking about the definition of contributor contribution on page two, possibly?
No, there's a whole section in here about if the contribution, which is not of monetary, but is of something of value, shall be given, shall be declared as a fair market value or a percentage thereof, or if that does not apply, in any event, it doesn't count as a contribution. I think that's almost a direct quote. And I'll find it for you in a minute as we go through this. But anyhow, we have been trying to get at this business of an in-kind contribution in Senate Bill 541. On page 4, in section 7, we find a very interesting piece of legerdemain. It says in section 7 on page 4, you know, what a political committee is, but nowhere does it address itself to a candidate in opposition to a candidate. It just does, in other words, you could have a committee in opposition to a candidate doing whatever it wants to do, financially or otherwise, and no report is required. This seems to me a strange rule.
By bracketing out the words.
How would you change?
Well, put back the word candidate. They've struck the word candidate. Restore the word candidate.
I see. Find it.
I just don't know why they did that.
May I ask another question? Have you, and don't misinterpret my question, has the attorney, it's going to sound wrong for a second, has the attorney general seen the amendments that you've suggested?
We paid him the same courtesy he paid us.
I don't know what that was.
Did you pass this representative room?
We have had no opportunity to see these amendments. I saw them day before yesterday is the first time that I saw them. By way of history, some 3 weeks ago I had a conversation with the Attorney General suggesting I get together with Mr. Durham to find out areas of agreement or disagreement that we could come to relating to a Senate bill of his. 309. I called Mr. Durham twice with no response. We have not had that conference, and if there is any statement made by the Attorney General's office that we are in agreement to any to the proposals of 3077, there's been some gross misunderstanding somewhere along the line. Also on page 4, section 8, it's very unclear language if you just stop to read it, and I would ask you to do so. It lacks sense. On page 5, section 2, sub 1, we find that a political committee shall appoint a political treasurer, but a candidate cannot. Yet in other sections of the law, later on, it addresses itself to a candidate's
treasurer.
Jack.
Yes, sir.
As part of this bill, as I recall, off the top of my head, the elimination of the personal report.
Well, we offered testimony on the Senate side and also to this special committee, of which is editorializing now, throughout the state, that was appointed by the presiding officers, then presiding officers, to come up with some new procedure to make things simpler for filing these C&E reports. We feel that simply by a form draft, a form design, you can have a candidate's and a committee statement on one and the same form. It doesn't require legislation to do that. The Secretary of State is by law empowered to design the forms that are used, and we recognize the problem. And incidentally, in the area of offenses, the candidate, the individual violations were the smallest number in the primary election of 72. Incidentally, the number of violations we had in the general election was virtually zilch. Virtually zilch, and if I'm referring to Representative Morris's zilch, my apologies. But there were very few in number. Why can't a candidate appoint himself his own treasurer? Jack, on page 6, section 4 says a candidate may serve as his own political treasurer.
That's correct. Now, we're trying to make the law clear and understandable by eliminating the language that they do throughout this. I think they're making it unclear. I've had conversations with members of the Attorney General's staff saying, look, we've got to make this law clear. I would submit to you that 3077 makes it much less clear than the present law. You look to a statute as to who appoints the treasurer in the present law. You have to look to at least three statutes in the proposed amendment to find out who appoints the treasurer and what that treasurer does. In the present law, there's only one statute. All right, true, it's suggested later on in the bill that you can appoint yourself, or a candidate, you can appoint yourself a treasurer. But if you wish a simple law, why complicate it? Subsection 2, on this same page, page 5. Why is it permissive for a candidate to reappoint a treasurer while a committee must? The elimination of the words just make no sense at all to us at all. Now, if a vacancy occurs in the office of treasurer, according to this law, these proposed amendments, a committee must reappoint a treasurer, but a candidate does not. Why? The striking of the word candidate or. On page 6, section 4. This is a mere rewrite of the existing section, of an existing section, and changes the meaning of the law not one whit. And I have checked this with attorneys. It is substantially the same, but it is merely a rewrite, and it just makes no difference at all. Excuse me, on page 6, section 4, I got ahead of myself a little bit. I would ask you to read that very carefully as a candidate to public office. There is an unwarranted presumption of knowledge here that I don't think is possible or true in national or statewide campaigns. The presumption being that the candidate is totally aware of what every member of his committee, what every volunteer worker is doing,
and I don't think that is true. If you want to use this logic to its, push it to its dry conclusion, General Westmoreland should be on trial for the misconduct of some sergeants in Vietnam who misappropriated funds from PX's. Now, I don't, under the present law, the treasurer is responsible, and the treasurer should be the responsible person. The presumption that each of you know exactly, and this not only extends to your own committee, but it extends to the guy that unilaterally does something as well, whether you are really aware of it or not. It says in here, if he knows, you know.
Am I reading the same section to our deck? Section 4, I see just talking about the political treasurer. Maybe you're
reading. I'm reading on page 6,
yeah.
Section 4.
Yeah, it says that that.
It says that candidates should be personally responsible for the performance of such duties and any default or violation by the political treasurer
will
also be conclusively deemed to be a default or violation by the candidate.
Right,
and
that
here
doesn't
I
have
says,
anything to do with all the committee members. Or it has to do with, as I read it, doing
okay.
The political treasurer, isn't that right?
The political treasurer, but who works for the political treasurer, you know? Now, there has been a pitch made that this bill will establish a single treasurer. It doesn't. No such way, because later on in the bill it says ancillary committees may do but so-and-so and so on. There's, again, no substantive change from the present law, Representative Kapori. I submit to you that Section 4 is an unwarranted presumption. Okay? On page 7, section 6, is also merely a rewrite and presents no meaningful change to the present law. On page 8, section 8 at the bottom of the page is, we think, an excellent addition because this is the estimate that a person must file during the interim period of the pre-election report and the day of the election. It reads very well and reads exactly as Senate Bill 571 as introduced by the Secretary of State and AFL-CIO Cope, except on page 9 under sub A there's some new language beginning and a statement of estimated expenditures and gosh, I Mr. Bell is the grammarian in our office, but and most any stupid thing I can read and go by it, you know, but I cannot understand this sentence. And a statement of estimated expenditures which will be made during the succeeding period ending on the day of the election, period. No expenditure, and here's the real good one, no expenditure shall be made during that period which exceeds the amount of the estimate by more than 15%. Now that's a direct lift out of Senate Bill 571 with a period, but you'll notice some handwritten notes. Or, which exceeds...
Those were amendments adopted by the committee.
Yes, and here's where it really throws me. Or which exceeds the amount estimated to be expended by an opposing candidate or political committee during that period, whichever is the greater. If another reason for these amendments is to make administration easier, I would submit that this is an auditing nightmare. You know, it just really is.
Well, if I could suggest what the committee's concerned about, the committee's concerned about that in providing some equity, whether or not wasn't as one candidate would spend X or estimate so forth higher, that the other candidate had a capability of meeting that too.
Well,
I don't know whether what the language, the condition of the language, whether or not it actually accomplishes that or whether or not it needs some amending. But
well,
if I recall, that's what the committee was worried about.
All right, if that's what the committee was worried about, so be it. But, wow, okay. Where were we here? Okay. We would also suggest that the dates as submitted in here should be changed. That is, the books close as of the 10th day and the filing be made on the 7th. We would suggest that these dates be made to conform to the Federal Campaign Finance Act. You know, it's 15 and 11 days. This is also found in Senate Bill 571, because a great many of our candidates are national candidates, are candidates in the national office, and this causes them to make two separate and distinct reports over different and overlapping periods of time. Which
15
seems to
and 11?
Yes. They close the books as of the 15th day, and the filings must be made as 11th under the federal law. Now,
did you say 7 or 11?
No, sir. Our law says the books close on the 10th, the report must be filed not later than the 7th. The federal law says the books close on the 15th day prior to the date of the election and are filed on the 11th day.
11th.
Yes, sir. Now, we think that it's reasonable that the pre-election filings be made the same, and as we have recommended in Senate Bill 571. On page 10,
Jack, can I ask you a question? The comments were made at the Saturday morning meeting that a candidate could go ahead and estimate his expenditures way up, $1 million.
Right.
All right, there's nothing in here to prevent that, right?
No.
All right, then all he has to do to comply with the law is give an inflated
There is
figure.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Otto, there is a real restraint here, though. These are a matter of public records, and I don't think any candidate is going to overestimate unrealistically that budget, or he's going to hurt himself materially in the eyes of the electorate. That's my own candid opinion. And I know, for instance, the sensitivity of candidates to reports coming out of our office, particularly when they're in error. And I'll show you the scars if it wouldn't embarrass the ladies if I stripped down to the waist, that I have suffered from the lashes of candidates who say, you showed me spending, you know, twice as much as my opponent because we happened to add two figures together, okay? Well, I'm trying to say, I think the estimates would be realistic and fast within the 15% or maybe 20%, you know, whatever it is. Up to 15% and no more. They'll try to keep them as close as possible. One thing we must remember, that the pre-election report contains all the contributions and expenditures as defined in the definition section. Now, about the only thing a person can spend during that last 10 days or the last 11 days are newspaper and radio spots. They're readily available. And I don't think you could even get a computer mass mailing out because it takes time to program, you know, and they must make that commitment or encumber those funds in advance of the reporting period, and they would be included in the pre-election report. I don't see how the present law aids the people who wishes to evade the law. I think the pre-election reporting was very good, both at the primary and the general election. Compliance, a little shoddy maybe in the primary, but in the general election, 90% of the stuff was properly reported. And I think the candidates and political committees are to be commended on this.
Jack, if you made a mistake in that reporting under the present law, what would happen to you?
There is a penalty involved. Under the penalty, there used to be it's a misdemeanor.
Under this, though, it's a class.
Well, it's still
class
a misdemeanor.
A.
Yeah. Class A misdemeanor, which is I don't know what Class A misdemeanors are. And incidentally...
$16.
Huh?
$16.
Well, that... You know, this whole, the stripping out of the violations from each section is interesting because I have in my office an attorney general's file, a formal opinion that says, in effect, the penalty is not clearly and well defined in the statute. These amendments make them less clear and less well defined. And they have recommended to us time and time again, oh, we can't go before a grand jury because the penalty is not clearly defined. Well, if they strip all of the penalties out and put them in a general section, I would submit to you that they're less clearly defined than they are in the present law. On page 10, section 10, we're getting into Gross House Bill 2242, which speaks of a single treasurer. Yet that bill really doesn't deal with a single treasurer. It tries to, but it doesn't any more than the present law does. There is an attempt made. Now, I'm sure that in all fairness, the person who made the presentation on these bills, on these amendments, must have spoken to the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. If he didn't, he faulted you. That is why there is no real demand for a single treasurer in the present law, because there is a First Amendment to the United States Constitution, which gives to each and every one of us the right to express ourselves. In fact, the bill provides for this. It says that if a person unilaterally, the amendments do, and the present law does, say that in effect, if I want to go out thinking Representative Kefauri is the greatest guy in the world, I can do a billboard so they run out my ears, you know, or by pages in the newspaper to support a Senator Kefauri, and I don't have to report it to nobody except the filing officer. I don't have to run that through a treasurer. The amendments that you have before you say that, and so does the present law. So when this section 12 on page 10 talks about a single treasurer, later on the plug is pulled. As the plug is pulled very beautifully in subsection 3 on page 11, where it talks about the state and central committees, you know. Well, if you want to evade the law, all you have to do is give the money to your state or central committee and tell them, by golly, you better give that money to such and such a candidate. There is a beautiful evasion. And it's provided for in the amendments to House Bill 1077. This is the amendment to 260.080 on page 11, section 13. No, excuse me.
082.
Yeah, they're attempting to amend 260.082. And there is a real hole that you can drive a truck through.
Could you explain what that means? I don't understand the section.
Well, it says, in effect, that if you give money to a county or central committee, that committee makes a biennial report under the present law. And all that money that county or state central committee contributes to candidates is not reportable until following the general election. That means that in a primary election, conceivably, candidate A spends no money, but the county central committee spends it all. And they do not make their reports according to the proposed amendments and present law until following each general election. On page 11, section 13, there's no amendment here, but we would suggest that it be deleted. This requires the Secretary of State to send out to all the county clerks copies of all of the statements of contributions and expenditures. This is a wanton waste of money. It's unnecessary. It's unneeded. The stuff is all reported by the press, and locals call in on regular intervals asking for this information. On page 13 of the amendments, in section 17, subsection 1A, this tells what should be, how a contribution should be listed, and it says it should list the name and address of a contributor. That's fine. We also here feel that our law should be brought into harmony with the federal law, which requires not only the name and address of the contributor, but profession, occupation, or what else. This is contained, this provision is contained in the Secretary of State's bill, Senate Bill 578. Here again, the federal statutes require it, and we think that it would be a benefit in ours. On page 17, and all of these skippings are just, we don't have any quarrel with them. On page 17, section 21, where they're amending 260.225, we'd like to have the words Attorney General struck. Here you set up, and it's in the present law, a dichotomy of responsibility. We would like to see all complaints sent to the city recorder, the county clerk, to the Secretary of State. The city recorders and the county clerk funnel those to the Secretary of State's office, where we treat with them and will describe how we think they should be treated later on. Okay, on page 19, section 24. The Attorney General has introduced a bill which he is justifiably proud of, and that's, open government bill that all the records of all state agencies should be made a matter of public record. But for some strange reason, he doesn't want the records filed in our offices on CNE reports become public records, because he's striking the language, a statement is a public record and shall be available for public inspection, da-da-da-da-da-da. He wants that taken out. Now, Representative Ragsdale said, well, you got, and I'm putting words in your mouth, Representative Ragsdale, you got to kind of read this whole bill together to make sense out of it. It would be a public record if you, as an individual, were totally conversant with the provisions of ORS Chapter 193. That is your open, public record chapter in the Oregon Revised Statute. But what harm is it putting it here to let people know that they can come to the Secretary of State's office or the filing officer's office and look at these records? But no, the Attorney General wants that language out. So we're suggesting that that language be restored. On page 20, we would like to have all of the old language restored. Delete the new language and delete the word Attorney General.
Right.
On page 21, subsection 3 at the top, delete the word Attorney General. Following subsection 3, we had asked for some new language. And I'd read that language to you, and then I'll explain why. A new section would be inserted with this language. The Secretary of State may employ legal counsel and other personnel to investigate complaints filed under subsection 3 of this Act. Secretary of State finds that a violation of any provision of the election laws has occurred, he shall immediately cause such violation to be prosecuted in the name of the state.
Now we're getting to the crunch. The real problem that's existed between the Office of the Secretary of State and the Attorney General. The law now clearly states that the Secretary of State may ask the Attorney General to investigate a complaint. And if based upon the findings of that complaint, the Secretary of State determines that there shall be a prosecution, he shall instruct the Attorney General to bring that charge, that prosecution, in the name of the state. The Attorney General said that law isn't right. He is the final arbiter as to what prosecutions will be, what violations will be prosecuted, and no one else. Now, what this new language would do, and I discussed this with Ways and Means, and they took $30,000 out of our budget because of the prohibitive cost that we received from the Attorney General's office as a result of fees for investigation and prosecution. We submit that this is seasonable work, and that we can, much cheaper and at a savings to the taxpayers of this state, hire an attorney and two retired police officers or someone who is knowledgeable in investigation and go out and investigate these claims. And that prosecutor, hired on an ad hoc basis by the Secretary of State, can relieve the Attorney General of the great burden that he claims has been placed on his office by the present provisions of ORS 260. We're willing to accept that. But we also would say that we need the Attorney General for opinions, official opinions, and we have no quarrel with that. Or we want the language left in there, the Secretary of State may employ the services of the Attorney General. For instance, a complaint came to my office today. I wouldn't think of going out hiring an investigator, an attorney. Why not use the Attorney General staff on these little intermittent complaints? So when the big massive complaints come in, I submit to you we can do it at one half the cost that it's charging us right now, and certainly relieve the Attorney General of this arduous job that he finds placed on his shoulders. And it would clarify once and for all who the man is that makes the determination as to whether a violation is prosecuted. Politically, and if I were the Secretary of State, I wouldn't want the job, but I think to be consistent and logical, the Secretary of State is the chief elections officer of the state of Oregon, and it should be his responsibility. It's awfully easy to pass the buck. I'm sorry the AG won't move, you know? And I've written a lot of those letters. And it's not right to take that kind of a duck. It's the Secretary of State's responsibility and no other. On page 29, section 36, notice how we just skip over all these are just deletions of violations. It doesn't really have any substantive change at all of the law. On page 29, section 36, we would ask to restore all of the deleted language and to leave the new language in, because the new language is good language, but we would submit that the old language is also necessary. Without it, you do have another sort of a loophole. It's a rewrite, but it says two things in ORS 260.512, which the Attorney General is trying to eliminate one of them. That's the first part, the language that we'd like to have restored. And I would say that tied in with that is the material that is found on page 31, section 38. And I'm in a little play, and there's a line in here, the court is flattered that clothes the mantle of a supreme tribunal. The Secretary of State, the Attorney General in section 38 has put in the word communicate. Now, communicate includes oral and video transmissions. And he's saying that no oral or visual communication shall be used unless it bears or is identified by the name and address of the person responsible for the insertion. I, not being an attorney, but I know that this flies in the face of the federal FCC regulations that tells how political advertisements are to be identified, and no way does it square with Section 38. And I would submit to you that the federal government does, federal laws do preempt state laws, except, or in those occasions when it's accepted.
Jack, could you tell us what the difference is?
Yes. The FCC regulation says that all paid political advertisements shall be fairly identified as such. Period. The record of the name and residence address and the committee whom the person represents who made the insertion should be a matter of public record and should be maintained by the station manager and should be open to public record, public inspection for a period of 6 years after the date of the insertion. So that anybody, you know, keep Oregon green, you know, you can go to KGW and find out who really was responsible for that spot. Let's stop and then you got a 10-second spot. Re-elect Al Dinsmore, your fighting state representative from Southern Oregon, Jack F. Thompson, chairman, 1238 34th Avenue Northwest. Where is your 10-second spot? That would be required under Section 38 of this law. It violates the federal law, that's all. Page 30, Section 37. I'm going backwards. We would submit that all the old language be restored. And again, be careful of the word communication in here, because you're getting into the area of federal law.
Is communicate defined in the bill somewhere?
No, it is not.
Your definition you're getting from where?
I'm getting from FCC regulation.
It's used and defined?
Yes, sir. Very clearly. Section 108.97. On page 30, Section 37 again, our subsection 2, is again an unwarranted presumption of knowledge which is impossible to achieve. The publisher or individual chairman or political treasurer. Now here it expands this area of responsibility to the publisher, the chairman, the political treasurer, of the publisher's, well, it says that he has absolute knowledge of what's in everything that goes out over the air, that's in the newspaper, however it is, that treasurer has absolute knowledge. And I say that is an unwarranted assumption. Subsection 3, this entire section should be deleted because it's in conflict with a prior section in the law. It says that only the word re-elect shall be used. But now, suddenly, 19 pages later, we can use words like elect, re-elect, keep, return, incumbent, or any of them, or, you know. So let's make it fish or fowl. Don't confuse the candidate in the political committee or the ad agency in trying to lay out some campaign material as to which of the statutes he's to comply with. So, you know, keep one or the other. On page 31, section 38, I'll discuss the FCC problem there. It's the same question. On page 40, and here again, we're skipping over all this deletion of violation debt that is included in the back, which somehow makes the violation of any particular offense clear. That's the I was interested to note that we changed the ability to hear something on page 37 from in a polling place from 50 to 100 feet. That's a rewrite of an old section of the law. I'm referring to 36 subsection 3, they delete the older language and rewrite it to accommodate 50 more feet of audio space, which is probably reasonable. So the guy just turns his knob up to 125 feet, and he's okay. I think that's an enforceable provision. The present one is enforceable, unenforceable. On page 40, section 50. Delete 260.520. This goes back to my first request to delete it from the first of the bill. My final comment is, the effective date is contained in section 51, says that this act takes effect January 1, 1974. Does members of this committee know what the reporting date is under this provision of the law? You begin reporting 250 days prior to the date of the election, which runs it back to the 1st of September of this year for 1974. In other words, by putting an effective date of January 1, you have effectively eliminated a great portion of the reportable contributions and expenditures to any candidates for the primary election of 1974. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to answer any questions. Oh, wait a minute. I forgot my supplemental. On page 15, section 19. Now, I discussed that the pre-election report is a fine and not a misdemeanor. I think the pre-election reports must be on file or it's a meaningless thing. What difference does it make if a man is assessed a fine on a statewide office of a couple $100 for not filing a report? It should be a misdemeanor. The guy should be hauled into court and a lot of publicity given to him, even if he's only fined $16 or anything more.
You find
I do appreciate the chairman's courtesy and consideration of the members' patience.
You mean we have a convict in our prison?
Several.
Oh,
well, Thomas ran again.
There are many policies and decisions to be made in the proposed amendments to 3077. But I would submit to you that the critical comments that the Secretary of State's office offered today have merit that should be considered by this committee. They do not involve policy. They are the hard facts of how a law is administered and how it affects the candidates and political parties, and most important, the people of this state. And I guess maybe that's a policy decision, is how you folks affect laws that enact laws that affect the folks. Thank you very much.
Anything further to be said on House Bill 3077? Hearing is closed.
Mr. Chairman?
There was somebody else here.
A question as to what the state is?
Chairman, there were two ladies from Common Cause, I believe. We have like questions, and we covered their testimony, or the questions they were going to raise. I checked very carefully with the lady. Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Blumenauer.
I'd like to know I was under the impression that 3077 was on its way to the floor. I'd like to know what the status of the bill is.
We brought it back to committee so we can put your name on it.
Yeah,
it's
still in the clerical mill of drafting. We would have sent it on probably Monday or Tuesday.
Didn't we have some amendments yet to be something that was still to be written into it?
It was in drafting down in LC. Don was working drafting, but now it's been reconsidered. So.
My intention to adjourn this meeting at 3 o'clock.
I'd make it 8 minutes.
We are adjourned.